Welcome everyone to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me as always is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Here today to give you our review of Shazam. We had the opportunity to check out early. Saw that on Saturday, March 23rd at an early viewing, and we bring that to you now.
Yes, Pete, and of course, with much discussion about, you know, is there going to be a decline in the movie theater experience? You know, there's now this premium on seeing these blockbusters opening weekend. There's now this model of the pre-opening weekend with these early previews. Our local theater, well, maybe not the most local because it didn't have Shazam for some reason, but the one that we went to that was fairly local actually had three shows that were all very well attended, so it all seems to be a good model. Pete, anything wrong with going to the movies, though?
Something was afoot when we got off the highway there, and through the roof of my vehicle, I thought we were being tailed by a drone.
Yes, there was just this sound that initially we thought was the wind catching the large, you know, kind of plastic backlit sign. Later, as we left the movie theater, honest to goodness, it looked like it was having some sort of electrical problem and like pulsing electricity kind of leading to this like wop, 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 wop kind of sound. And it was just, it added to the surrealness of the whole experience.
So not some kind of weird windsock viral marketing machine in front of the theater to get people for this event that night. Interesting. And then once we arrived at our seats, Matt, once I arrived at my seat, had clearly been pierced by somebody's switchblade and just like taped back together.
And interestingly, because we were in the second highest row in this tiered theater, when we got up to leave and I kind of turned just towards the projection room, if only just to turn to you as we chit-chatted and I put on my jacket, there were stacks of presumably clean, unripped seats that were at the rear of the projector room, just adding, again, this was a unique experience going to see this movie. Pete, this is not some theater, by the way, that's like down by the docks or the train yard, you know, outside of which itinerant people play the harmonica or whatever. You know, this is a theater attached to a successful mall. This is a theater that Kevin Smith himself has been to. Indeed, this was the theater where he went to go protest a Kevin Smith movie because he heard from somebody it was bad and hadn't seen it, but he was told he needed to protest it. So again, this is not, you know, the ramshackle, you know, two screen dying theater of old.
It's not, and that made what we experienced all the more strange. And indeed, you know, this was a 7:15 movie. You factor in the previews. We were getting out of there, you know, roughly 10 o'clock. It was crazy crowded at 10 o'clock with what seemed like people heading into the movies and not away. And then there was a broken beer bottle and all this glass by my car. You know, Matt, it begs the question, should we feel unsafe leaving a movie set in a murderverse?
Well, I guess here's the good news, Pete. They've heard the trumpet call. Aquaman, a delight. Wonder Woman, an uplifting experience. Shazam, to my recollection, and we're obviously about to go through the movie proper in a moment, I don't think there are entire swaths of buildings of people murdered. I don't think that there are necks snapped. I don't think that, as Zack Snyder said in last week, and I will parse his terms ever so slightly, I don't think this movie has an effing murderer who has to effing kill people. You need to understand his vision is supreme of Zack Snyder. Indeed, Pete, I don't think there's much Zack Snyder imprint on this movie. So hopefully it gets better.
Yeah. So we'll begin, Matt, with the prologue. Strangely, you know, an angry rich kid is not good enough.
Yes, and to start in the 1970s, I want to say 1974.
Yes,
certainly it was a little. It was a slightly shocking moment. Like, but wait, the movie proper takes place in the present day, and this and that. So it had me hooked there in terms of the mystery of it. I must confess, you know, Pete, this is what happens when you see previews. I knew that the Mark Strong character later in the movie wore glasses. It was about, you know, if this prologue is 6 minutes long, it was maybe 3 minutes into it where I was like, wait, this kid has round glasses too, much like Mark Strong, who plays someone later in the movie. I think this is his prologue, which is certainly an interesting way to do it. And we get John Glover in a fantastic DC presence here. Pete, you said better than his role in Batman and Robin. The question that I want to ask, perhaps rhetorically, I know we have our pal Tim out there who's a big Smallville fan. Is this better John Glover than Lionel Luther?
I mean, that's up for him to decide, and not, you know, being a big watcher of Smallville, I will defer. But yeah, to have him in here as Savannah's father, you know, the presence in that early scene when the kid is judged not good enough because he's lured by the seven deadly sins and wants to choose that power over the power of good. And then back into the Cadillac he goes, the bully father and older brother, they spin out. And then when the dad is deferring his attention to yell at his son, get absolutely T-boned by a car, something that shocked the hell out of Matt.
Yeah, and I don't have any particular phobia to seeing car crashes on screen or that sort of thing. You know, I know sometimes, Pete, I had a friend growing up, he had had a bad experience with a dog when he was, you know, eight or something, and then, you know, didn't like dogs, that kind of thing. But to me, just there was a veracity to that car crash, as shown in this prologue, that kind of surprised me, particularly with the tone I was expecting. And I don't know if that's just me. Although I will, Pete, I will argue for much of this discussion that there are tonal issues with the movie, and maybe this is the genesis of it, that I was expecting one thing and got something else out of that scene.
I had overall a generally positive view of the movie. I was fine with that there. And then to consider, I do see tonal problems with it. Largely, it is consistent, that a little bit aside. And then you consider some of the consistency issues. When you cast Dejaim and Hansu, albeit under the beard and the suit, as the Shazam wizard, when he was also a character in Aquaman. So when your concurrent universe has the same actor playing different roles.
Well, and I will argue with perhaps some fault to my argument that there's elements of this movie that the solution was, well, kind of copy what they did in other comic book movies. Now, I say that maybe there is a fault in that logic just because, you know, doesn't everybody do a theme played with French horn to show hero, because John Williams did in 1978 Superman the movie, and things of that sort. And, you know, again, the comic book hero movie is, of course, filled with tropes and is, of course, filled with things going back to the comics for several decades, for 70 years, for 80 years, and then that's built upon Greek mythology and Western culture and all of that. So I'm not saying that, you know, why isn't Shazam this completely new thing? But starting with Hansu as a character here, I kind of feel like, get me that guy who was in Guardians of the Galaxy and also voiced a guy in Aquaman. He's good for comic book movies. Let's make him the wizard. Oh, and then we get points for, you know, interesting casting and not whitewashing, which, Pete, I'm all for. And Jaimin Hansu is a perfectly fine actor in a, you know, less than perfect wig and beard. But again, if, to me, there's a certain feeling of, oh, he's been placed here because somebody else said he worked great in movies like this in another movie.
I'm fine with the casting. I just find it incongruous that he'd been used in another role. I believe the role was CGI, so you get away with it. But I've seen comparisons, Matt, from other people that have checked out the movie early on, that this is this era's Richard Donner Superman. And that could not be further from the truth. I don't know what they watched. It wasn't this, particularly given the length of time with which we draw out to build Billy Batson.
This is a perfectly nice trip to the movies, or if you're watching on home video, it's a great night to make some popcorn and stay in. This has a reported budget of $80 to $100 million. Yeah, I would say kind of, you know, it doesn't come off as cheap. I don't want to suggest that, but it comes off as a, even budget, Pete, that's that word sounds pejorative, but it comes off as a slightly lesser attempt with lesser results, and that's okay. But I feel like, again, between what I would argue is kind of the wholesale lifting of parts to make a new thing, old parts to make a new thing, and maybe a lesser budget, you know, they're aiming for less, and there's less of a result here versus, as you said, the Superman movie that defined, period, yeah, what a superhero movie could do. And Pete, at some point, when we're not in the middle of podcasting four different shows and two different movies in the next 6 weeks and this and that, the other, the Superman movie is something that we should go back to, because having watched like the first 15 minutes of it a couple months ago, it is an incredibly modern movie. It does all the things that these movies do. And guess what? It wasn't invented with Iron Man or with Sam Raimi Spider-Man or with Bryan Singer X-Men. It comes from there. It comes from the Richard Donner Superman movie.
Which is why, you know, the tongue should be bitten with the respect that you should show to Richard Donner Superman, instead of trying to say that this film is that, or that this film is better than Wonder Woman. What? Or that this movie is better than Aquaman. It's not. It is, as you said, a fine time at the movies. It is not the dark, foreboding piece of crap that is Batman v Superman. It's also not the neutered thing that is the Justice League. They've course corrected. They got jokes now, Matt. It's light. I had a little bit of an issue with how much we're spending on the kid before the kid finally gets the opportunity to go to the wizard and, you know, choose whether he's going to do good or do bad.
Perhaps, Pete, lifted from the Donner Superman, where we spend quite a long time with, you know, young Clark Kent.
But that's part of that. That's different. And again, the reverence of the character, I think, demands that. The big backstory for Billy Batson, I don't think so much.
Well, particularly since with Superman, to know Clark Kent in Smallville, and then, well, I guess in the movie he's Superman before he goes to Metropolis, but to know Clark Kent in Smallville is to know the core character. There then just happens to be superpowers added to that, you know, that mythic, you know, middle of the country sense of work ethic and honesty and pride and Americana, etc.
Are you saying that's not important in Philadelphia?
Well, I think what I'm saying is, insofar as this is a story of a 14-year-old boy who gets given the powers of super space man, of a superman, do you need to get every little last level of character stuff here? I certainly applaud getting to know a character. But again, there's kind of this tonal thing. Do we need to set up the mom punch in the gut in the third act? In the first act, we need to set that up so that in the third act we can say, oh man, mother rejects me. For truly, the Sand People have taken Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. And I then at that moment look up, wind in my face, and I am man. You know, like, do we need that, or can we stick with dude, I got superpowers. This is incredible, which is the core of the movie, this notion of wish fulfillment for a young person, which we can all remember being young, and we can all, you know, we can all hope to look like Zachary Levi, etc. But yeah, again, it's kind of like, oh, the book says we need to have an elaborate backstory to really understand. And to be fair, Pete, I'll just throw out one more thing about backstory here. We are also coming from a primarily Marvel perspective where when you need to do a backstory, sometimes it's already been done for you, i.e. Black Panther does not need to set up, you know, the first 20 minutes of Black Panther, quote unquote, well, they were already in Civil War, so we can hit the ground running, whereas here there hasn't been, you know, the least iota of setup.
It's true. The family formula that they create, what with the foster parents, you know, the dad is Jerry from The Walking Dead, okay, and the kids is well done. There they nail the tone. They hit all of the beats of recreating the family. We've got the other brother, you know, Freddie Freeman, who, you know, is knowledgeable in all things superhero, whereas Billy is our everyman soon to gain the powers, and he needs the mentor character. You know, the foster brother is the Obi-Wan Kenobi. Darla is cute and what she should be. The older sister who gets into college on her own, Matt. I don't know what they were thinking writing this movie in 2017, early 18, how that would happen or backfire.
The key triumvirate here in this movie, it's of course Zachary Levi as Shazam. It's Asher Angel as Billy Batson. And yes, I know Zachary Levi is playing the Shazamified Billy Batson, but, you know, bear with me here. And then Jack Dylan Frazier as Freddie Freeman. It just works so perfectly. And some of the other sins of the movie, though we might catalog them, the sins don't outweigh what the three of them bring, along with the cast that you've mentioned.
Yeah. So, you know, in addition to Cooper Andrews as the dad, you know, the little boy, Ian Chen, who plays Eugene, who's, you know, a favorite from Fresh Off the Boat. You know, we hit the Asian gamer trope. And then, you know, we've got the other brother who, when he's ultimately Shazamified, and, you know, kudos to them for keeping that under wraps in the marketing and not, you know, bowing to that temptation, you know, gets the beard and is the big, huge, you know, member of the group before Zach Levi finally shows up, and he is the heart and soul of the movie. Tremendous casting there, and they just nailed it.
Pete, I love once Shazam arrives, or at least the Zachary Levi portion of Billy Batson, this YouTube conceit of, we're not just going to record this for posterity, but we're going to record it for clicks. It is completely in line with modern culture today. It's something that, you know, captures now versus, you know, some earlier age, and totally works, totally believable. And it also lets us do a montage without it being a montage. You know, it's like it is and it isn't. It's just, look, we're watching a bunch of YouTube videos on the movie screen, just like at home we click through YouTube videos. And then, of course, that culminates in kind of the fullest understanding of powers when they head to the convenience store.
Yeah, and it is of this age. You have to imagine it was part of the pitch. Okay, we're going to give this kid these powers, and he's going to test them out, and it'll be viral and hit all the buzzwords and tropes of today. And like you said,
that might have been such a fresh portion of the pitch that the now ousted head of Warner Brothers might have looked up from his phone long enough to be like, hey, that sounds new. Back to what I'm looking at on my phone.
Is there a spot for my girlfriend?
Oh.
Could she be the cashier?
Oh, former head of Warner Brothers caught being a dog. Sorry. Here's your exit strategy. But Pete, take us back to that convenience store.
Yeah, you know, the dream of every 14-year-old kid that you're going to be bulletproof and, you know, you get rewarded in real alcohol that tastes like actual vomit.
Pete, who among us at a legal drinking age has not finally opened a brew and been like, wait, this isn't as fun as it looks on the movies? It takes a little bit to develop an old taste there. But yeah, I mean, it's just this is the heart and soul of the movie here, this wish fulfillment where, you know, where it's a teen sneaking out, acting like not just an adult, but a super adult. And these are the most fun parts of the movie. Pete, I wish that we didn't need to return back to a central conflict, or either emotionally or physically, that we could just have fun with this.
I had hoped the movie would be a little bit more of that. I know you took particular exception with the bus sequence.
I totally buy the need for the, you know, potentially high-flying Shazam, who now, you know, certainly at this point of the movie, he's not named Shazam. But, you know, that he makes this mistake and the bus falls off the thing. And is it going to fall? Isn't it going to fall? Totally original scene, said Steven Spielberg for Jurassic Park 2. But again, it was like this thing of, I'll buy a bus falling, you know, teetering on the edge of of the freeway cliff, if you will. But then when people start falling and there's crunches and there's blood and then the bus itself just falls, to me it was this tonal thing versus, let's say, Pete, in the first Deadpool movie, which I know is a slightly different basket of powers, but like when Deadpool jumps off the freeway and lands in the truck, like you buy that it's not real because the things being presented, there's not a weight to them. There's not a weight to his landing. Here it's like, oh man, the guy who was on the bus because he's a paralegal at a mid-level Philadelphia legal firm, he just fell 30 feet onto his face. I'm worried about him. And who did this? Zachary Levi did that. Zachary Levi hurt that poor man. And you know, and now I'm angry at Shazam, but I shouldn't be. And again, kind of this tonal stuff here where I was torn.
As a way to figure out the power that they've not tested, that he can be crushed by a bus and still save it, it works. As a feat of physics, Matt, it is a failure. So I will concede that to you. But do you know what else is a failure?
What's that, Pete?
That would be your teen mom who abandoned you, who is a piece of garbage and smells like fish sticks.
I hope that you're talking about the one in the movie. Okay, I have thoughts here too. It's an interesting way to take what drives young Billy Batson to find his mother to resolve this thing, which I think is completely sympathetic. The unknown, unexpected disappearance of his mother when he was 4 or 5. I buy that as character motivation. I buy that her life has changed to a degree where she doesn't necessarily want to reconnect. It would have been nice if we had more of a cinematic clue that she was a teen mom as opposed to just a young woman in those flashback scenes. I mean, all it would have taken is like, if it was a t-shirt with like, I don't know, I'm trying to do the math here as to when it would have been, you know, but if it was a t-shirt that was from 10 years ago of the hottest band at the time, you know,
it takes a line. We talk about this quite a bit, like, oh, come on, honey, I'll get you the tiger another time after I get home and finish my calculus homework. Like,
or like, is this your little brother? No, it's my son.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Now all of a sudden I'm more emotionally invested.
It doesn't take much, and it felt like they were hitting us over the head to suddenly declare, no, this was a teen mom, and that's why she did it. And is it me, Matt, or, you know, we never see the husband slash boyfriend. I think there was more than a tinge of hinting at abuse, and Billy leaves her.
I would agree. You know, we also talk about kind of TV code you know, shot by one bullet, you're okay, things like that. You're gonna make it after you put your arm in a sling. Off screen husband or boyfriend yelling, "What's going on over there? What's going on at the door? Why aren't you here? Get over here." I mean, that's TV code for abuse. Can we know for sure? Is there on-screen evidence? No, but that certainly is the TV code for it. And Pete, I only wish that this 14-year-old boy had some sort of way of stopping the abuse. Oh, wait, he's a superhero. Do we pick up this thread? No, we do not. Versus, you know, Superman getting the cat out of the tree. Maybe that's not as important a thread, but point is, we have a beginning and middle end to that, and we feel good about it emotionally. Here, it's just completely unresolved. Oh, I guess you didn't want me, Mom. Good luck.
And that comes across disingenuous in terms of the heart that this movie's trying to provide.
Or it was shot and edited out because runtime, or because keep it peppy, or whatever it is. I bet they shot that scene.
It makes sense from a writing standpoint that you'd follow that through. Curse whatever editors, Matt, would cut that the same way we would curse them, because we get in narrative nods to Batman, the Batarang, the throwing of the Batman doll, voiced by Kevin Conrad, no less, to Aquaman. Okay, the kid, the other brother wears an Aquaman shirt, and we've got the secret scene later. I put that in sarcastic air quotes. We'll talk about that at the time. But nothing to Wonder Woman apart from a quick, glimpse in the cartoon credits. I mean, do you even girl, bro dude?
Pete, when I took my daughter to see Captain Marvel, which, you know, was seen the same month as we went to see this early showing of Shazam, when I went to buy the tickets, I saw that the last row in the theater, you know, highest up, was completely sold out. And I was like, oh, it must be like a group thing or whatever. You know, all right, I'll get two rows away, because if they're loud or they're this or that, you know, I kind of like my space. I'm going to a Saturday at 10 a.m. show for a reason, to not deal with, you know, ill-behaved children. And when we took our seats, was kind of vaguely aware that there were, you know, there were young people and there were adults there and whatnot. It was only at the end of the movie when I got up that I realized that it was what appeared to be like a boys' little league team or something like that that had gone to go see Captain Marvel. Point being, I guess the conclusion of this movie is that Freddie Freeman can only like the boy superheroes that are in the world. I mean, think again, here's my point, Pete. Think how powerful it would have been if it was like, here's the Batarang, here's my Aquaman t-shirt, here's a Superman bullet, and here's the Wonder Woman blank. I don't know exactly what it would be, but you know, here's the
I hold my belt up with something that looks like the lasso of truth. Again, how much imagination does it take to nod to commercially, not, but critically, yes, hands down the greatest film in this connected universe?
I'll do you one better, Pete. They couldn't get Henry Cavill to do the Superman cameo.
Whoa,
right?
Whoa. What are you talking about, Matt? In that first credit sequence, there is very clearly a man in a Superman suit. I know, because I saw him from the bus down.
Here's my point. You have a Wonder Woman movie that is still being worked on and a star that isn't trying to exit. You have Henry Cavill, who, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, was like, no, I'm not doing this cameo. You couldn't go back and be like, I mean, look, you don't even need to change the whole, I understand there's Superman's bullet and this and that, the other. You're telling me that you couldn't reshoot that scene to get Wonder Woman to turn the corner and show up head to toe and go, yeah, and even just that, like, then the discussion, Pete, would be, you know why they didn't have Batman and Aquaman? Or you know why when they had Batman and Aquaman and Superman references earlier in the movie? It's because they were holding the best for last, the Wonder Woman cameo at the end. Instead, Like, you know, again, I don't know what that would have cost. Maybe Gal Gadot is like, no, maybe she's in the same boat. She's like, oh, no thanks. And they didn't want to go 0-2, they being Warner Brothers. But think how great that would have been to have that moment. And you would have had this transcend, you know, maybe not transcendent, but you would have had this gender moment where, look, everybody's cheering for the boy hero and the girl hero at the end of the movie.
Given that this was the last film in that original DC extended universe slate, it could have been a culmination. And instead, kind of like this climax, less than the previous films, it is not this overwhelming CGI casserole of confusion where, you know, people scream no at one another and throw things. But it's still not really what it can be.
Me personally, I would argue that some of the Seven Deadly Sins smokestone monster things, that some of their inclusion is too scary for younger members of the audience that they're trying to woo. I think of when Thaddeus Sivana, you know, gets revenge on his father and brother and the rest of the board, you know, is it too much for me to watch? No, but that's using, it uses kind of these tropes of, you know, the person against the glass, help me, and they get pulled away. Has people thrown out buildings and not being saved? Things like that, where it's a level of brutality, again, not offensive, not outside the PG-13 rating, but, you know, there's a reason why in a lot of these movies there's the trope of our heroes fight CG people. Because, Pete, in the army attack portion of the climax for Infinity War, when it's, you know, the dog monster things, when you see an 6-legged dog monster thing get cut in half by, an energy shield, do you mourn for it like Fido? No. Do you mourn for it like, oh no, I think they just cut a real man in half? No, you kind of go, oh, it's a weirdo bug alien thing, let's kill more of them. Here you see real people being killed at least in that one scene, and then I think that carries some of the oomph in the scene where they fight at Christmas Village and Santa Claus keeps running away and later is drunk and cursing to the news, which is great. I just can't wait to have my kid see that and be like, wait, is Santa Claus always drunk and saying the bleep word?
Listen, it's a real question. I got a kick out of it, but it does make it less than completely family friendly. I say this after I was asked by a childhood friend, hey, can I bring my 5-year-old to this? And I said, yeah. And now you're making me rethink that.
Again, just my perspective. I mean, flip side, you know, like my daughter watches all these Marvel movies and, you know, 95% of Star Trek Discovery, even the TVMA episodes, you know, like I'll cover up for when the one brief scene where, let's say, Laurel is showing the full body makeup and the other scene where Laurel's throwing wee ones down to the fiery pits. Other than that, it's like, I feel like I'm pretty broad-minded, but I could just see this not going well.
The Philadelphia climax works on the level that, okay, we kept this lid on the rest of the kids turning into Shazams. Applaud there.
Excuse me, Pete, you mean the Shazam family?
The Shazamses. Okay, who live next to the Joneses, keeping up with the Shazamses, or should I say Shazamses. And that is very cute. It's less than thrilling in a superhero sense. There's never really the sense of peril, but with that you lose the murder verse motif, so we'll allow it. Of course, the bullies who have picked on Freddie and, you know, also Billy are imperiled and they get saved, but just barely. So it works on that level. But yeah, still with the over dependence on smoke monsters and a lack of a sense of physics and gravity and everything there.
I think that in this Shazam family showdown at the end here, special mention must be made for actress Megan Good, who plays the Shazamified Darla. She just nails the, you know, 8-year-old now transported to adulthood aesthetic, and it really, really gets sold nicely.
They did a great job casting on both ends of the kids and then, you know, the older Shazams. Really give credit there, and particularly Darla on both sides. And that's where I come away asking myself, is this a sequel-worthy film? Or will it be the type of thing that, all right, we include him in future team ups, you know, if we ever get another Justice League, who knows there after Snyder's statements this week, I really have to wonder, what the story will be there. Does Shazam 2 get a green light? I think it remains to be seen at this point.
Well, Pete, let's not forget that every broad appeal movie, the hope is that it'll be successful enough for there to be a sequel. Nobody's ever doing, you know, and thus, you know, and thus Superman gets killed off forever for good in this first Superman movie. You know, there's always that hope for a sequel. I think to whatever degree that they were saying, what's the best template that we're looking for here in terms of tone, well, maybe it's like a PG-13 Deadpool, if that's your elevator pitch. PG, you know, a 14-year-old boy becomes a superhero in a movie that is a PG-13 fun time at the movies like Deadpool, but definitely PG-13. It sounds like a recipe for a sequel. Certainly that lower budget, which maybe I was indirectly taking a dig at before, that also does make it much more likely that you can have a sequel. Because if you, you know, if this one, again, reported between $80 and $100 million, that's not a lot of money. And that should, you know, short of a massive bomb, this movie should be a worldwide moneymaker, and all the more reason to do another one, particularly with such an affable star as Zachary Levi, who, Pete, I had watched earlier this calendar year as Dr. Benjamin on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I had no idea he was such a good actor. To see him in these two wildly different roles, I mean, I know he's like, he's been around, and Pete, I know anybody who was anybody around on New York Comic Con this past year on the Sunday went to his session. I mean, everybody was there if you were at New York Comic Con, but he's a great actor. He really, really is.
Yeah, and that's where I think I come away as a B-League DC superhero. This is a good effort. As an overall DC film, this is a good effort. Does it warrant more? It does. I just wonder, with their slate, with their cast of characters, you know, we're getting the Wonder Woman sequel next year. That was pushed back from this summer. That's fine. You starve the demand after you had Aquaman, which people were super worried about, us included, at Christmas time, and now this. So within the space of, you know, 3-4 months, you've had two films. You're going to starve it for another year and change. Okay. And then where are you going past that? You know, Affleck has bounced from Batman at this point. Henry Cavill can't even lend his chest and his midsection to a cameo here. So gather from that what you will. Just wonder where they are going forward. I guess the gate of this will determine whether there's a Shazam in 2021 or not.
Pete, I know we had discussed off mic in the last couple of days this notion that where Marvel has really pinned itself on, it's all connected, to a point that I would argue, Pete, that Kevin Feige is now trying to shake off the Marvel TV hangers on from his perspective and take over more of that in regards to what's being made for Disney Plus. But it seems like it seems like DC is now entering this phase of embracing it's not all connected. I mean, yes, these people have heard of Batman and Aquaman, but it's not about the transfer from the last movie and the setup for the next one. whether we're talking about the totally weird Joker movie that's coming out, or questions of, well, how does a Wonder Woman 1984 that takes place before what we've already seen, so it's a sequel and a prequel and a this and a that, how does that fit into the larger thing? It increasingly seems like the DC Films response is, don't worry about how it's all connected. Did you like Aquaman? Great. We're going to do another Aquaman that's like that. Did you like Shazam? Okay, we're going to do another Shazam. We're going to do another Wonder Woman, and it's not about setting up Justice League 2, the end of justice, the rise of the villainous super people, you know, in 6 years. Maybe DC and Warner Brothers have found out that that model just does not work for them, though we have had Thanos teased all these years on the Marvel end, and we presumably get some kind of conclusion later. I shouldn't say later this month, because we're recording this at the end of March, but, you know, in the next 30 days, we presumably get the end period of Thanos' involvement in the MCU. Looks like DC and Warner Brothers are saying, don't worry about 6 years from now. Be worried about the next movie, and if that's good.
But is it, though, given some of the teases we've gotten in these end credit scenes? You know, we've got Lex Luthor out there now with Deathstroke. We've got the first secret scene in this film that gives us the worm that's escaped from the Shazam cave, glimpsed early on, that visits Dr. Thaddeus Sivana in prison here, which is not name-checked, but you don't need to look for much to find out that that's Mr. Mind.
Well, we get a Shazam villain teased in a Shazam movie, which I think is different than, you know, I don't know, take your pick. It's the end of a self-contained Black Panther movie, but here's Bucky, who we're going to see again in a couple months' time in Avengers when the fight gets brought to Wakanda. And I'm not saying that was too much in Black Panther, but it had that moment of, don't forget there's a larger thing, versus, hey, Shazam's going to fight a Shazam guy, maybe in the future.
I guess. And then when you stay all the way through, you know, Matt's asking me, is there another scene? Yes, there is. We stay all the way through. And yeah, there's usually the serious one. And then there's one that's more of a ha-ha. You know, look to Captain Marvel, where you've got the pager, right? You know, we get that. And then we get something lighter, like somebody throwing up a Tesseract. and this second one is cute, but for it to be basically a cut sequence from earlier in the film, like, oh, we're going to tell whether you can breathe underwater or not. It's an Aquaman ad now on Blu-ray.
Yeah, that was maybe the cruelest ending of all, or the worst post-credit scene, in that it clearly was just something that they took from the body of the movie when it should be this special thing. And I know they're not always special. I think back, and I'll be honest, Pete, I've forgotten which Marvel movie this is. It might have been Age of Ultron at this point, but whatever it was, where it's, you know, Tony Stark giving his therapeutic revelations to Bruce Banner, and Bruce Banner's asleep, and it was like, wait, I sat through, like, that wasn't even a, if you're going to give me something that's inconsequential, give me an ant playing the drums. Give me a ha-ha where it's the last little, it's the mint on the table after dessert. Don't give me, hey, do you remember that steak that you had? Here's some more steak. But now, Pete, let's talk box office for this opening weekend of Shazam. Doing $53.4 million worth of business. Rounded up to almost $57 million when you include the special Fandango event, the Saturday evening shows from a couple weeks ago. And according to those wizards at Box Office Mojo, looking at probably about $160 million domestic by the time it has had its run.
A tidy sum. I think the critical praise has matched the commercial. And thus begins the little window it's going to have before Marvel comes in with Avengers Endgame and takes all the money.
And honestly, it's probably the same window that most movies have now. I mean, I really feel like gone are the days of, you know, I know there's some crazy stat, I don't have it in front of me, like E.T. was in the top 10 of the box office for like, you know, 38 weeks or something like that. And you go, oh my goodness, that's 3/4 of a year. You know, we're Titanic in the top 10 for 25 weeks. Now they just open big, open huge, as we're going to see with Endgame. And I think even with that, you know, a month after Endgame comes out, where is it going to be? It's not going to be at, probably not going to still be in double digits, that kind of thing. So it shall fly as high as it does. Shazam will. But Pete, would you like to hear some feedback from people?
Absolutely.
Let's start with a tweet from our pal Mary Kirk. That's at Geek Kirk. She says of the movie, it was delightful, not compelling enough for a rewatch in theaters, but I'll buy it to watch at home when I want to pick me up a flick. I don't rewatch many comedies, but Zach Levi was super charming.
Yeah, I would really agree with Mary here, and she knows her stuff when it comes to superhero fare. It was engaging, but not to the level that we need to, you know, watch over and over again and dissect all the details.
Will we see some chin from Henry Cavill upon rewatch? I don't know.
No.
Pete, also a tweet from ZP International. Really good film. Lots of laughs from the audience. Couple of dark bits, but helped with the story. The big fight was fun.
It was. And, you know, leaving aside my qualms about some of the CG, at least it wasn't this overwhelming CG people here against CG people here type of thing.
And lastly, we had a direct message from our pal Tim, who says, finally, the real Captain Marvel movie will be champion at the box office.
Wow, that's a low blow, and I regret that he typed that.
Also, I mean, look, to be fair, first of all, there is no DC versus Marvel. Show me good movies and I will go to fun
right.
movies.
We want to be entertained by all. Fantastic Geek makes no bones. We are the voice of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, not the disjointed DC, hey, we have a Flash on TV. We have a Flash whose contract is expiring in the movies that we didn't think enough to plan around, but that's neither here nor there. We want to enjoy both of them. I think we might have deeper love in our pasts for the DC pantheon than the Marvel pantheon.
Indeed. And I mean, just to point out that Marvel's Captain Marvel did 3 times Shazam's box office its first weekend and more its second weekend than Shazam's first weekend. So I'm not quite sure where there's some race to number one. I mean, it's kind of apples and oranges in terms of, like, fine, you win a weekend. It also depends on your competition and whatnot. But I don't know. I'm confused as to the need to have these two characters duel, unless, of course, it's that one represents your underpants parts and one doesn't, and therefore one makes you feel comfortable and one makes you feel much afeared.
And that makes some people very small.
Well, Pete, this episode and indeed all that we do made possible by the people who go to patreon.com/fantasticgeek and help lend their support there.
Absolutely. Everybody who contributes gets access to exclusive podcast content. And then there's all sorts of levels, tiers from there. If you want to pay enough to get a lightning bolt on your chest and be considered a member of our family, we will figure out an amount for that.
But Pete, the best is always free. It's talking to you on Twitter. You figured out the world of electronic social media and clickety clicks just like Freddie Freeman has. So how can people be in touch with you?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, PieterJKetelaar, KetelaaR, 10,384 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I'm personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast. Comment on FantasticGeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, on Instagram, on Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with a PH, all one word, like it today.
Pete, looking ahead to the now and the near future, we, of course, have more Star Trek Discovery to talk about. We are looking ahead to Cloak and Dagger, looking ahead to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., looking ahead to Avengers Endgame. Certainly an exciting time to be talking all about this. Have I left anything off the list, Pete? Because I know it's piling up.
the little bit of God friended me left Matt with that finale on Palm Sunday, fittingly. So always busy in these parts around Fantastic Geek, never more so.
Well, with that, I will say adios to all our listeners and give you, Pete, the final Shazam word.
Shazam!